Sounds good. I am Chris Marks. I'm at Harvard, and as you'll see, I'm interested in lots of questions in experimental evolution. And so my goal, especially, I had some slight forewarning from Michael to ask to try to be really broad. I didn't know that I would be the lead-off speaker, but I tried to make this. I figured to get started, some of what I'm saying here, you know, there are people in this room who have done this for some large multiple of the amount of time that I've done experimental evolution. I won't say who you are, Paul, but so it certainly, there will be information that some of you will no doubt have seen. Sebastian has taken my class and has seen, you know, even these exact same lecture notes. So I've really stolen some information from how I teach about this subject, and then tried to sneak in some bits of research, particularly kind of at the end. And welcome. I think this is this. You know, any questions? I may, for some questions, if I think they're particularly off track, decide to maybe I can talk about those afterwards. Because I think I may have bit off a big chunk of things to cover. But I think it's important for particularly for people kind of coming into this field to think about what sort of experimental data would one compare to what a lot of us think about in evolution and how. How are these experiments set up, and why, and what can actually be measured? What are kind of the drawbacks? What are the advantages of doing various sorts of things? And so I'll see kind of how much of this that I can cover. And so I'm going to, the basic kind of structure of things, I'm going to talk a little bit about just kind of like how, at the start of an experiment, how these things look and how you set them up. I think even just really briefly, because I think it's really important when we talk about, say, a selective coefficient, well, so how, given the growth conditions, what does that selective coefficient mean, and what, how are they growing during the type of things that are done? A little bit briefly, we talk more if desired later in terms of kind of a really important aspect that's come available in the last few years in terms of how do you find the goddamn mutations that we care about, because this was not very feasible until just recently. Highlight one point also that mutations are not equal to SNPs. SNPs are mutations, but there are a ton of things that are not SNPs that are, in fact, rather important. And then talk also about the fact that selective coefficients, we often talk about some mutation has some value S. Well, this S is not just a value. It's not just 0.05 and stuck. And talk about kind of a few different things that affect what this S is. And of course, depending on how your experiment's set up and what you want to study, this could matter just a little bit quantitatively. It could completely qualitatively change the picture. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. So in terms of, I am going to truly do this the way that I do it when I teach. Note I'm using an overhead projector for this lecture. They're very useful. Let's see how this, I don't normally do this also standing up. I think I can manage. There you go. So I wish Steve Jobs would pay attention because, if a Mac, if you actually put this on an iPod, an iPad and a computer together, it's actually quite a nice device. They have yet to do that. He's scared of a stylus somehow. No Mac device ever has a stylus, which maybe for a phone is a good idea, but for here I think it's quite nice. I can write much better than I can finger paint. For an example, I figured I'd talk about kind of the most famous example of experimental evolution. So these are Rich Lenski's experimental lines. Is there anyone in the room who's unfamiliar, who's never heard of these lines? It is fine. A couple? Excellent, thank you. But for many people have no doubt probably heard about them. But in terms of thinking about it, kind of exactly, if I were to ask you to be able to write out the exact details of how it was set up and why, my guess is it might be a little bit less than 100%. But so this was all done with E. coli, and it's now up to greater than 50,000 generations. So it started in February of 1988, when he was still in Irvine, and it has continued for a long period of time in Michigan State. So for those who know, there were 12 populations that were started with the same ancestor. And so it's one thing, so one thing that I think is really fantastic about microbial evolution is that it really, it's not just a selection experiment, it really is an evolution experiment, in that both parts of evolution, the generation of variation and selection upon it, occur. Because most of the time, at least, when you say you have some population of Drosophila or something like that, and you do some, you know, you can expose them to ethanol or do whatever, you can certainly have selection, and there's recombination, something that's absent here. So it's really important that there's not any vectors. So in terms of this E. coli strain, there's no vectors for horizontal gene transfer. So they're not naturally competent. As people know, with E. coli, you have to really, you know, electrify the shit out of them to get DNA in or do something else to them. There's no viruses, there's no conjugatable plasmids, etc. So as far as we know, they should be completely asexual. Of course, it'd be kind of hard to know if some miracle event did occur. But what is nice then is you can start populations where there's no genetic diversity within the population, and there's no genetic diversity between them. It's essentially one genotype, and get to start from there. And all mutations arise de novo, as well as drift and selection acting upon them. But this same ancestor was actually two different ancestors, Era plus and Era minus. And Era stands for Arabidose. And so this related to two different facts. Why would you want to start with two different ancestors? They're otherwise identical. The main thing is you can, because they're Era plus and Era minus, you can tell them apart on a plate. So if you put down a mix onto a plate, that quote TA, tetrazoleum, what you end up getting is some of the colonies will turn up as being red and some of the colonies will turn up as being white, because those who can use arabinose will respire, and those who can't use arabinose will have to ferment the other things that are present. So arabinose isn't the only thing. This actually is also a rich medium, and those that ferment will change the pH very quickly, and the tetrazoleum is a pH sensitive dye, and so for a period of time they very nicely look different. This really should be described as looking dark pink and light pink, because anyone who's actually done this experiment knows that there's this, like, this window of time. They're too small to really see the colors. The colors look really nicely different, and then they begin to blend back in towards each other. And so there are two reasons to start with two different ancestors, and it's an important point. One, which I'll bring up later, is competitions, so you can tell the damn things apart. So microbes are great in many ways, they're not so great in some, one of which is to just, you know, be able to see what the hell's going on and know two things that are otherwise very similar from each other. So this was done for competitions, and I'll describe that later, as well as to try to distinguish contamination. And so at least, and so the way this was set up, so it was 12 flasks, and they were alternated, kind of like an Era plus and Era minus, an Era plus and Era minus, etc., to try to maximize the chance if you were to screw something up, you'd introduce like red cells into white or vice versa. Also, if you go to plate them out, you should see, like, if you line up all the plates, all reds, all whites, all reds, all whites. If it suddenly goes red, white, white, red, red, etc., then you know you flipped like two of the flasks, and what you were calling Era minus two is actually Era plus two, etc. So it gives some kind of identity to the strains. So those were kind of the two reasons for using different ancestors. So in terms of growth, and this is an important point, this was done with daily transfers. So this can be called serial transfers or batch culture, etc. And there were 1 to 100 dilutions. So what does this mean? This is 1 over 2 to the 6.6. So they're going through 6.6 generations per day. And as I'll talk about in just a minute, there are different ways you can do, you can do experimental evolution in many different scenarios. Like Oscar already mentioned, like spatial structure. In this case, there's no spatial structure, right? This is still kind of a changing, a seasonal environment, if you wish. You can do growth in a continuous environment. There are trade-offs to this. I'm not going to talk today about chemostat growth. I'd be happy to if anybody's curious in terms of why it, in some ways, is better and why, in many ways, it's not. I'd be happy to. Later, but I want to put that off for the minute. And so the experiment, to some extent, is really rather straightforward. You have 12 flasks. Every day, you take 12 sterile flasks, put in fresh media, actually a 13th, also a blank. You fill them all up with fresh media. You go, pull them out, try to keep them in order, go with pipette, take 100 microliters. So in this case, it's 100 microliters into 9.9 mils in 50 ml flasks. So from the point of view of microbiologists, to use a flask that's only this big is kind of small. Certainly, there are reasons to try to culture smaller than this. We have, and I'll talk about kind of briefly what we've done, other groups like Michael Desai's lab has gone to like 384 well plates, and there are many great advantages. There are also sometimes disadvantages to using kind of various sizes of culture. But so I'll bring up some of those aspects later. But this is kind of just the scale of what was done. And then, really importantly, these get frozen down. And so in this case, it was every 500 generations. And so I think, you know, and the really important aspect is this, of course, gives you a living fossil record. If you put in this case, some glycerol to help them survive freezing, you have your ancestral strain alive, these original Era plus, Era minus strains. And then you've got these, you know, mixed populations through time across all the various populations. And I think this is the other thing that's really remarkable about microbes. Yes, they grow fast, and that is convenient. The population sizes, as we'll talk about, also are certainly tremendously important in terms of the number of beneficial mutations that can arise, but the fact that you can bring them back alive, this may be the single most important thing, in that you can go back and you can compare directly an ancestor and its progeny many, many generations later and put them side by side. I think this is really amazing. And it means that experiments that were done in 1988, we can now go back and sequence strains, you know, stuff that the work was done 20 plus years ago, and now we can throw, you know, Illumina sequencing, et cetera, at it, or anything else, you know, that comes up down the line. So it's really great, I think, the ability to be able to preserve. The media here was minimal salts with glucose.
Hey, Chris?
Yeah, please.
So, do you know that the doubling time is still the same?
We know that it's not. It is sped up quite a bit. I'm going to mention just a second. Yeah, yeah. No, it's changed substantially. So
another question. So this kind of dilutions, they maintain exponential growth?
No. I'll show even on the next phase. They don't at all maintain. So this is minimal growth in glucose. And
it's M9 medium, right?
Davis minimal. Similar. But, iron citrate. So, as some of you may know, so citrate is something that E. coli can't eat, or at least most E. coli. There are actually some natural E. coli that can. And one population, after 31,500 generations, found a way to be able to successfully utilize the iron chelator and grow on that. And so that's its own really kind of interesting story, two things. But essentially, for most of the experiment, there was just one compound, and it's E. coli's kind of favorite compound. And so most people, you know, you ask, how fast does E. coli grow? You know, the student answer, you know, 20 minutes, right? Well, it can be. They're really, really happy in an extremely rich medium. Yes, it can be that. Here, where it's minimal media, et cetera, where they actually, where what minimal media means is that there's, you're not adding any vitamins or amino acids, et cetera, that it's just inorganic salts plus glucose.
So Chris,
they have to synthesize everything on their own. Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out that in nature, they probably only reproduce, you know, a dozen times a year. Unless
in our guts?
Yeah, under special conditions. They're a very, very minor component of the gut, less than 0.1%.
I totally agree.
And so, you know, the while convenient for testing theoretical concepts, the fact is, to the organism, this is an extremely artificial type of environment.
Absolutely. And I make no doubt whatsoever about this fact. Any lab, so yes, glucose is their favorite thing to eat if we had to pick kind of a single substrate, but this is absolutely a very, very new situation for them to be in. It's very constant, there are no other things going on, there's no other organisms around, there's lots of things are different. I take I'm surprised at the number of 12 generations per year. I don't know how that's calculated, given that I think they can grow in the gut. Like, the population size is very low, but is that inferred from population genetic data or from?
No, it's just the point. Most organisms, most microbes grow very slowly. I mean, typical soil, some microbes have on average a couple generations.
Yes.
You know,
and also I think that during their lifetime they don't spend most of their time in the gut.
Yeah.
And once they're released into the environment.
Absolutely.
It may not be optimal conditions for
them. Yeah, my understanding has been that for things, so a lot of the model organisms, and this is the same reason why they were chosen, that for the yeast, the bacillus, the E. coli, et cetera, things like this, they can, when they're in the right conditions, so like for the period of time that they are in our gut, can double substantially more than once a month. But they spend a lot of their time in the lake waiting to get back in to your gut, sort of
scenario, right? As a model organism because they went to the sewage treatment plant, right? And the first things that came up were the ones they chose.
Right. So. Yeah, absolutely. So I think, I mean, the fact that they can grow so incredibly, like, I do think it is relevant that there are times that these bugs, those that can grow incredibly fast, I don't think it's entirely fortuitous, but it's not always a daily life. And certainly, and there may very well be trade-offs between these things and all sorts of other scenarios. But so under these conditions, where it's just, like I said, it's just inorganic salts, et cetera.
Chris, can I just break this?
Yeah,
sorry. I agree with what Matt says, but I'm not sure that anybody really has figured out to what extent the natural environment, say a lake, is a sink or a source or a legitimate. It could be that the things that get excreted don't find their way back in to guts very often. I don't think we really know the ecology of gut microbes well enough to make assertions about, you know, the relative amounts of time. And I don't think anybody's done it.
I completely agree with you, Paul. I think the relevant issue here is that one thing we know for sure is that this test tube isn't
absolutely
natural situation.
Yeah. Totally. And that's a good thing in this experiment because it gives them a target, adaptive target that's far away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so certainly this is, there's no doubt whatsoever that this, or basically any condition you come up with, I think one would be incredibly hard pressed to actually know the life of your bug well enough to provide an environment that is exactly what they're in. I actually have I think, like, if my feeling is if you did actually know that environment and you set up this experiment, then you would see an incredibly slow rate of adaptation. Because if they lived in a constant world, first of all, and if you actually were able to mimic that constant world, I think they'd be in this point of relatively slow, asymptotic, little selective coefficients, not nothing. I don't know if I believe in an adaptive peak, but that's another question. But I think things would be very slow at the very least. And here, this was certainly anything but slow initially. So under these conditions, their growth rate is on the order of about 50, 60 minutes. And it about is twice as fast, approximately, by the end of the experiment. Currently in the experiment, it's still going. Not surprisingly, this is E. coli. It's 37 degrees C, shaking flask. And so the shaking, of course, is so that it's both mixed and to keep the oxygen high. And it's also actually very low glucose. For those of us, like Paul, we've been lucky enough or unfortunate enough to have to go in on weekends and actually transfer these lines. When you actually look at the flask, most of you would not believe that it's grown because the glucose is so low, 25 milligrams per mil, I believe. It's milligrams per liter. Yeah, micrograms per mil. It's the OD is like 0.05-ish, in that kind of range if an OD value means anything to you. So it's relatively low. So you have to actually compare it to the empty flask that you're using to make sure that you meet it. It's very at the end of the experiment.
Almost
all of it is very low, actually. And there are reasons which I can go into in terms of why the OD was why the glucose was kept relatively low. And similar experiments have been set up with high glucose and did produce kind of some qualitatively different results. But let me, if anyone's curious about what those are, I can actually talk about them later and relate to something I'm going to bring up later in the talk. And so under these conditions, the final numbers in a flask, something like 5 times 10 to the 8th initially, and thus 5 times 10 to the 7th cells per mil. And so, given that in LB, you know, if you want to do a mini prep, they grow up to something like, you know, 10 to the 9th per mil on that kind of order. This is much, much lower than what you would ever think of with plasma being done growing. Any conditions could be used to do experimental evolution, many choices I think are arbitrary. It's up to you, but of course it's going to change what happens because the conditions you use are going to very much affect what sorts of things will be beneficial, what's the likelihood of having kind of interesting interactions going on, or so to say just competition, etc. And so in terms of thinking about the dynamics of bacterial growth, what would this look like then through time? And so if you were to look at cells, so this is time, 24 hours. So how long will it take for the cells to finish growing then? They're only doing 6.6 generations. They're doubling in about an hour. They're basically done, actually, after about 6 or 7 hours. So so if you were to look simply at the number of cells through time, it would look something like, you know, approximately like this. So you could say, if anything, Rich wasted a lot of time.
That was considerable lag. I think it's more like kind of, it's not just taking off almost immediately, but lagging and then taking off, right?
It's measurable, but not considerable, actually, under these conditions. I'll get to that in just a second. Because it's hard, you'd have a very, I mean, so if you just simply follow the number of cells, you'd have an extremely hard time being able to pick up whether, like, our eyes are not very good at seeing slight deviations from exponential growth or not.
And so the better way. So what is vertical exponential?
Just simply number of cells. So I didn't.
No, label but how do you measure this?
So there's different ways.
What is experimental?
You can do optical density. This has been done in multiple ways. Where you're just seeing how cloudy, how much is it between, you know, a glass of water and a half of ice. You can look at, you can plate and do a plate count of colonies. They even use, I can't even think of what the name of that device is. That
Holter counter.
Remember how this, like this?
C-O-U-L-T-M.
Where this is kind of a flow cytometer-like device in that you're passing single cells through, but in this case you're measuring kind of like the electrical properties as they pass through a little tiny orifice. You can use flow cytometry. You can do a direct count under a scope. There are lots of different ways that you could do this, and they'll all give essentially, assuming, I mean, there are some, like the optical density per cell can actually change and does somewhat, etc. But essentially any of these measures could be used to follow cells through time. And the reason why I didn't label the axis is because I also wanted to say, then what happens to the substrate? What would the substrate look like during this period of time? And so the substrate is going to do the opposite and essentially move relatively close to zero. So if this is your glucose. And so, what's the, you know, and in a perfect world, when the cells are halfway grown up, they will have used half of the resources. And so the last half of the resources is used only in the last generation. So if you were to look at this, the better way to usually look at growth is to look at the log of cells through time. Because then, if it's an exponential process, of course, you'll see a straight line. And then you'd be able to see what Eugene was mentioning, is in an ideal world, you'd see a picture that looks something like this, where there'd be some lag here to get started, then exponential growth, log phase, unlimited, whatever, and then stationary phase. Now, reality, you know, I mean, this is drawn kind of in the massless, frictionless pulley way of thinking about biology, that there's kind of this immediate transition to all these different things. That does not have to be. But you can take growth curves and kind of effectively, you can pull these parameters out as if the lag was just kind of an instantaneous switch to exponential growth. And it's actually remarkable just how close real data are to this picture. I mean, it really, really is very close to this. And it's
similar.
For E. coli, well, actually for a lot of bugs, it can be fairly close. It doesn't have to be under all, and even in E. coli, it doesn't have to be like this. For example, if they're not very well oxygenated, the actual growth curve will slow down, and it's hard to tell because it's still going to be maybe somewhat curvy, but the actual growth rate is slowing and slowing and slowing and slowing. It's become more and more oxygen starved, or if they begin to poison themselves due to, you know, changing the pH, or, I mean, there's lots of other reasons, yeah, where it doesn't have to be so pretty. But for a lot of bugs, at least, the data are remarkably close to kind of the perfect, what a physicist would like to see out of a growth curve. So just to get a feel of this lag initially, 40 minutes or something like that, I think, on the order. So it's something.
It is very, very much depends on temperature.
Fair enough, under these conditions.
Yeah.
So what it means is under these conditions, the lag was less than a doubling time. And so what is selection acting on? Right, because we're going to be talking about S, you know, or a fitness value, W, or whatnot. What is selection acting upon? It's actually acting upon, of course, all aspects here. But what's going to matter kind of the most? For these cells, under these conditions, at least initially, there's very little death in stationary phase. Now, this happened to change in one of the populations that actually has kind of a long-term polymorphism because one lives fast and dies hard, and the other can eat the parts very well. And so there's actually one population that's had two lineages stick around since like something like 5,000 generations for the next 45,000 generations because one of them actually did have a ton of death in stationary phase, and the other one could eat up those scraps. But at least initially, the ancestor didn't die very much. So if you don't die, you can't really improve upon not dying. But there is still selection, purifying selection for that.
Just the term stationary phase can be really confusing, I think, because mm-hmm. it's really, you're not seeing any difference in the cell numbers, mm-hmm. but for instance, you could be having a lot of death and a lot of growth occurring at the same time.
Yes, you could. Under these circumstances, you actually don't. But it could be happening. I completely agree. And certainly if you, in this timeline, you know, if you run this experiment longer, I think as we were talking about yesterday, absolutely you would see kind of some internal growth, even though yeah the net numbers don't change. But it's a good point to bring up. Stationary does not mean they're just completely holding still in the freezer sort of situation. So also the lag is fairly short. So it means that there is selection to decrease the lag time. But you can only decrease it so much. So let's say your lag time went from like a half hour to 0 minutes. You can just immediately grow at your top speed. That would give you like a half of a doubling advantage. But that half of a doubling advantage is now going to be spread out over the next 6.6 generations. And so it essentially would work out to be like a 7% fitness advantage. And that's the maximum that you could possibly achieve by cutting your lag down. So it's not to say that it's nothing. But there's in these circumstances, there's relatively little. You can imagine a circumstance, what, you know, if you had some bug that the lag time was 2 days, and then they grew with a 10-minute doubling time. Oh, okay, now this is different, right? Now, if you could move the lag time up just by a couple hours, you'd finish growing before they even started, and it would change entirely. So it's like, in this, you know, you could think about it in terms of like, you know, if you're running a 50-meter dash, you get down on the line, and you really matter about how you get started, because this matters substantially. Marathon, you don't care, right? And so this is relatively close, you know, it's middle length run, that it matters, but it doesn't matter a ton. So what matters the most? By far, the most selection is upon exponential growth rate.
Just a second. So suppose you had actually two different nutrients, and one was preferred.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, will both be used right away? Increasing rate of growth, or will it eat one first and then eat the other? So I almost expected, you know, as you explained this, I'm still thinking, so what are they going to do with the iron sulfate? So I was sort of expecting that they would be mostly using it in stationary phase.
Well, initially they basically don't use it at all.
Well, they can't. But the question is, so the ones that do,
yes,
there are strains that do. So mm-hmm. how do they grow?
They grow very fast initially, eating glucose primarily at least, and then switch to citrate relatively quickly. And so you would see, so like in, if there was two substrates, you could see something that looks like, say, maybe this. until that ran out.
You may then say that selection is not in your exponential phase or log phase, but rather in stationary state.
Well, it's not stationary. In this case,
it's not stationary anymore.
In this case, if you do have this kind of dioxic, eat one thing and then eat another sort of growth, then, and often that lag is fairly long, and actually that was one of the major things that changed with the citrate growth, is the amount of time between being able to switch from glucose growth to citrate growth. So in that case, because that was very long, then there's a lot of selective pressure upon that. No, I'm definitely presenting this in the most simple scenario, and things only get more complicated. And I think one of the major themes is that, of course, if one wants to tackle just some parameters, if you want to think about things, mutations as having simply one value of S and not some really complicated scenario, then a really simple world is better for testing various theory. If you want to tackle things that are more interesting, if you want to address the real world, then it's important to start with some simple factors and then build in more factors, multiple substrates, multiple this. What about if you have a predator? What if you have this? What if you have spatial structure? What if you have, et cetera? And I think a lot of people are moving in different ways to add extra parts.
But these bugs, physiologically, these bugs live in the range of temperatures, because if there is any ecological truth to that, they live not only at 37 in our guts, but then when they, whatever. And my point is that at low temperatures, lags are hugely extended. People see that, and we see the same thing in the lab.
Right.
So it's basically hugely extended. So again, that returns to the question, when lags are longer, then of course the one which has longer lag and much faster growth will lose to the one which grows slowly but without a lag, because it will eat up all glucose by the time the other one starts to grow infinitely fast.
Completely. So this is my point that I was bringing up, that any conditions can be used, but will absolutely change what it means to be the winner, right? And anything you do in the lab is not going to reproduce what they do in nature. I think these are very important points, and I think it becomes one of the things that's interesting is to you get what you ask for. You just often don't know what you're asking, right? The mutations that arise are going to be answering the question. They're going to be better. But often you have no idea what the question was until afterwards. And certainly we've had fun examples of this, and you can learn things from learning something new that you never knew that you were asking them to do. So I completely agree to say that exponential growth rate is what experimental evolution selects upon, that is the last thing I would ever say. But I'm saying the canonical experiments that are set up for this reason, because it's a long period of growth and a very short lag, is why these two things, and if you look at the correlation between exponential growth rate and fitness, as we'll talk about in a second, how you can actually measure kind of the sum total, they're extremely well correlated in many experiments, not all. You definitely have situations where they're not well correlated because other factors, lag, death, some sort of interaction, be it positive or negative, et cetera, comes into play. Absolutely.
So, Chris, has anybody looked at what's happened to lag time in 50,000 generations?
Because you can
imagine that even, a 1-2% difference over, as you keep having a selective sweep that gives an advantage to cells like that, but you should get some decrease in lag time.
It has decreased. The lag has decreased, but I don't think there was a paper, Vasi, I think, et al., like 94 or something.
Yeah.
It looked at it in the first 2,000 generations.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone has actually looked at lag since.
Okay.
So, I totally agree that it probably has changed to some extent. But the main point is that it can certainly give improvement in small, early on, small improvements aren't going to be the winners for lots of reasons, but then later on, these smaller things will have a much greater chance of being what's relevant.
Also, any idea how many times the cells were passed before the experiment was begun?
So in this case, this is a strain of E. coli B that has been in the lab for a damn long time before. There's no doubt that this is also, so yet another layer is, how wild is your wild type?
It's actually much older than the K-12. It is the one which was brought from Europe to U.S. by Delbrück and company, and then was given to Yeah. Scale to other
people. Well, yeah, so Bruce Levin worked on this strain, and then Rich and others.
It has at least extra 50 years in the lab compared to K12.
Yes. And so what does those 50 years mean? I mean, there's going to be some combination of, you know, if you pick a colony that have been sitting there forever, you know, like drift can certainly, you know, you can just have immediate fixation of things. There'll be selection to probably survive an auger slant, because for a long time there weren't minus 80s, right? You know, and maybe, you know, some selection initially, you know, when these things were, you know, obtained from the wild, you know, in terms of doing some sort of enrichment, all of the above can change things. And so actually, yeah, for many things that may not matter, depending on what you're asking. For some things, it may matter substantially. And so we actually have switched for the model system that I study, from one that's been in the lab for 50 years to one that was just isolated off of a wild, in this case, a wild Arabidopsis plant, so that we know that it's as kind of as fresh can be, and we hope to hold it kind of in that sort of state.
Yeah. Could you comment just a little bit on the choice of the dilution factor?
Yeah.
You kind of alluded to the fact that they could have done maybe twice as many generations per day, rather easily. And if people want to do these experiments in their own lab, how should they choose?
There's two. Yeah. So it's a good question. So if you did a 1 in 10,000 dilution, right? So that it would be twice as many generations per day. I think it'd be entirely feasible to do. So some people have tried to keep with batch culture, keep them constantly in exponential phase. It's actually kind of a bit of a pain in the ass to be able to do, because you need to change something. You can't just do like a constant dilution at a constant time. You need to either be measuring the cells to change the time between dilutions, or keep your dilution the same, or change the degree of dilution and keep the timing the same, which is more practical. And so like Michael decided an experiment where he diluted them every, I think, 12 hours, and did so for like a couple months or something like that. It was, and it's really a pain to do so. I think the you can get kind of more generations per day if you do a larger dilution. You will, of course, be changing the effective population size, right? And so effective for what? Largely, you're going to be, in terms of kind of how important drift is going to be, because the bottleneck, you know, what really matters is kind of how many times did you go through that bottleneck? You know, because while they're expanding, you're not going to see, you know, drift playing any role. It's during these bottlenecks. And so, you know, if you are bottlenecking, so like I said, the final population size here was like 5 × 10⁸ when they started. So they were only bottlenecking through 5 × 10⁶. So even though it's a very small culture in terms of how dense it was, that's still, I mean, 5 million is still a pretty good sized number. So if you drop that down to 50,000, all right, it's beginning to get somewhat smaller. You drop it down further, you know, things are going to certainly change in that regard, and many people probably don't care, you know. But some people, it certainly in this room, I think, would care. And if anything, that's an important variable that people would want to think about changing. Is the effective population size. It's also fair to say that it depends upon the actual growth conditions, whether or not, if you change the dilution, will that affect their physiology? So basically, if they were to start life at 50,000 or start life at, you know, 50 million, is that growth essentially the same? And many times it can be, but there are actually some fun examples where cells can't start unless there's a large number of them, even in like a flask. I run into this, I know other cases of this. What exactly is causing this is often not known. Whether you need enough of them to release like some chelator, or to actually make CO2 in the media. There have been various sorts of things that have been found. So sometimes a really, to dilute to extinction isn't just diluting them, you're also affecting their world in an important way. So there's a lot to think about in that regard too. Yeah.
Going back to this question, what does selection act on? And so you said that people also try to limit selection to just exponential phase. And so accepting that selection is acting on the rate of growth, right, which is a reasonable assumption. There still is a big difference in sort of the two-phase growth situation as an exponential and stationary, because it may well be easier to improve on zero rate of growth in a stationary state, then improve on whatever once per 40.
In this sort of situation, where zero rate of growth because there's citrate. Yeah. Let's imagine, you know, there wasn't citrate, and they do actually grow without citrate. It wasn't actually necessary. Then there's, like I said, if you're not dying, then it's hard to improve upon that. But let me, so I want to mention one other important point, actually. One thing that you might think that's kind of remarkable is that exponential growth rate goes through this entire period of time, despite the fact that the concentration of glucose is changing. Like, glucose does run out. So glucose is limiting, so this is limiting on yield, on the number of cells that you get, but for a long period of time, it's actually not limiting in terms of growth rate. And why is that? So if I were to put kind of the effective KM of the cells for substrate, so kind of what's the concentration of glucose that would support half maximal growth of E. coli relative to how much you start, the KM is very, very low for most substrates. So even here where you're putting a pretty small amount of glucose, I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, something on the order of maybe a millimolar, it's fairly low. It may even be below that. But often the KMs for glucose for substrates are on the order of like tens of micromolar. And this is something that also can change dramatically. There are some substrates where the uptake is really poor, other bugs have incredibly good uptake, etc. But because of that, it means that the growth rate is essentially constant for this damn long period of time. And it does actually slow down, and there is still glucose around in stationary phase, but just a really low amount. And so now they're substantially limited by the rate at which a random glucose molecule and a cell run into each other, whereas for most of the period of time, there's so much glucose, it just doesn't matter at all. And so it's because, you know, like if you were to trace out like where the KM value is versus growth, like they don't becomes effectively limited for substrate until, you know, like the end of the 11th hour, you know, sort of thing. Like it's really right there at the very end. So most of the growth occurs prior to the glucose running low. And it's because of this, then under these circumstances, that, and with a short lag, with not much death, etc., that growth rate and fitness are so well correlated to each other. So, yes.
I mean, when we say growth, we're really talking about reproduction rather than, right? Because we're talking about the number, talking about the growth as being.
Depends on which way you measure it, but yeah.
But, so, I mean, that's what selection or fitness is, right? It's the ability to leave progeny in the next generation. So you can imagine you could live for 100 years, but if you never reproduced, your fitness would still be zero.
And be one massive E. coli cell. Yes.
Exactly.
It is true that these things can be somewhat uncoupled for some period of time, but not forever. Like you can imagine, what if I just divide without actually accumulating biomass? I could pull that off a couple times, but some, like,
right.
This is gonna run.
I mean, most selection is in the growth rate.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it's gonna be anywhere else.
But it could be somewhere else, because it could be on lag, it could be on not dying in stationary phase, it could be, like in more complicated scenarios, it could be the ability to uptake something.
The only way you're going to make it to stationary phase is having gone through the exponential phase to begin with.
Correct, but you could, so what I'm saying though is that you can imagine two strains have identical growth rates, but shorter lags, or two strains have identical lags, but shorter growth rates. So like, would you rather cut your lag in half or double your growth rate? And in this case, there's a substantially larger advantage.
But
to doubling your growth.
But this is a key word here, because
absolutely.
If you have a limited amount of substrate, this is true. If they compete for some fixed amount of substrate, then of course all these kind of trade-off considerations play a role. Imagine that the substrate is kind of, it's like hemostat, that you have it unlimited.
But
then of course the lag issue becomes a bit.
Lag is gone.
Shortening the lag, is just quickening your ability to reproduce.
No, they're different. These are two separate parameters. Lag and growth rate are definitely separate. The same mutation could affect both, but they're definitely distinct.
I understand, but you're still talking about reproduction, because if you're shortening.
But it's initiating reproduction versus, you know, like your maximal rate of reproduction. Those are.
I understand that, but we're still talking about
when you say
the
growth,
ability to reproduce.
Chris, when you say growth rate, you mean the slope of the exponential.
Yes, thank you.
And when Thane says growth rate, he means how long until we get to the end.
Sure. So let me turn to a fitness competition, and so you can see kind of like how like there's another way of being able to kind of follow these things through time that kind of integrates all of the above.
I just want to ask a trivial question. Has anybody measured Km in the ancestor, for glucose in the ancestor under the evolved lines? Because
originally, yeah.
That's a window for Boris's idea that you can, if you get a better Km, a lower Km, then you'll do.
You could extend.
Won't count for anything until you get to stationary phase, and then you'll be the only one still growing.
You'll be the only one still growing, but there's so little glucose left that there's not much advantage to be taken. I'm not saying it's none, but it's small.
All right, so Km is so close to zero, just like lag is so close to zero, that everything is focused on the slope of the exponential.
Yeah, yes. Under these conditions. I can't possibly say that enough. So I guess this probably was, given the number of questions, at least somewhat useful to go over some of these very basic things.
Because
I
think it's slide.
Number two. Three, actually, I had an outline slide and did four because I had a picture of a pretty leaf. But I think it's important because, of course, these are the experiments that are done to test theory, right? You know, et cetera. And so I think it's important to know what are the sorts of things that that can go on. And as you can see already, there are a zillion different ways that it could be done, as well as how different lab is from real life. So one thing is, so you can imagine, and I'll talk about it in a second, you could just measure the dynamics of growth. Because if all that matters is kind of like whether or not you have a particular genotype has net death, how fast they grow, how long the lag is, etc., you can just measure the growth of one thing, kind of in one lane of a race, another thing in another lane of a race, and you just from there, you know, parameters, like bicycle time trials, or you know, when people do skiing down a hill, where each just runs separately, and the winner is just the shortest amount of time. And this certainly can be done. One of the issues is accuracy, it's as well as just trying to do this in a high throughput manner. And so one of the things that like my lab and others have done is trying to turn the ways to be able to do this somewhat more high throughput culturing, both from the point of view of evolving populations as well as being able to follow them. And so one thing that we've done is we've been using an automated robotic system that in a warm room, there's a plate shaking tower, and there's a little thing here that so they shake within here, and there's a little lift that pulls plates out, sets them here. This lifts up the lid. They can come out here. The arm picks it up, sticks it in here, takes readings, sticks the thing back, and you go, etc. Now you don't want to do this while you're evolving them. Why? You don't want contamination, right? So like while they're evolving, you just leave them in the stack and let them kind of come back out, whether it be daily or 2 days or whatever your time period is. But the nice thing is, then we can measure these dynamics of growth under the exact same conditions that the evolution occurred in. And it's taken a lot of work to get this set up. A lot of it's been done. Nigel Delaney in my lab has really pioneered this. And the nice thing is, so like this is 40 replicates in terms of exponential growth. I've left it in this case not in log transformation, but you can see that you get incredibly reproducible growth. And if you were to look at this in log, I mean, these are just straight lines. You can get really nice measures of growth rate by doing things in this sort of way. So if people are curious about the kind of details of how this works, I'd happy to talk about that.
Why is the noise largest in the dip in the stationary?
You know, it's a good question. It's not clear exactly why there is. It's probably one possibility is small differences actually in like pipetting, in terms of like the volume of the medium, etc. is going to change the kind of how much the total, because this is not path length in a cuvette. This is looking up through a multi-well plate. So if there are slight deviations in terms of how much we're pipetted in there, or slight differences in, like, say, how much there was evaporation or something like that.
You mean the amount of glucose in there?
Well, it would end up being the amount of glucose because the glucose is mixed in first in the media. Well, it's not glucose here. This is actually methylamine in my bug. But in any case, the amount of substrate is going to be exactly proportional to the volume that you put in there. And so that probably accounts for some of the variability. It's not so bad. I mean, in terms of like how much variation, but you're right, there is more variation here than here. And I'm not sure exactly.
I guess the question is variability is just a matter of the accuracy of measurement at a given optical density? For all I know, maybe they clump together, and that's why...
Anything, the accuracy gets better as the OD, because this is all within an OD range that's really easy to measure accurately.
Right, so then the question is, But I think there's some morphological change occurring in the station. You know,
there is.
Yes. Starting to eat each other or something.
Well, I mean, you can look, like, if you look, all right, so, like, you can see how this is actually curving, right?
Yeah.
Right? You know, like, there is.
Why does it curve? I couldn't understand that. Because, I mean, if they die, OG would not see them dying. I mean, because OG will be the same.
So what? I mean, so what's actually happening?
Not seen an OG.
Yeah. So, like I mentioned, in kind of the perfect world, they grow absolutely exponential phase, and then in an instant they stop. Of course, this is not reality because there is a KM, and as you get closer and closer to that KM, you actually do begin to slow down, and the KM is simply half that rate, and then you move down to a quarter of that rate, etc. And so there is a slowdown, and it depends upon the bug and the substrates and everything else, how much this curves over, as well as, I should actually mention, if you use high levels of glucose, E. coli, depending on what substrate you use, often will stop growing because of pH stress, either going up or down as they get to higher levels. And so it's not always just because the substrate's running out. In this case, we know that it is, the substrate running out. But if you notice, they actually all tend to kind of curve down and then flatten out. And what's actually happening is that there's a slight change in the shape and size of the cells. And that's relatively consistent across different organs. So in this case,
a direct cell count rather than an OG measurement.
Then here and here, there's actually not a drop. Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
So basically, well, change in cell volume.
Yeah, slight change in cell volume as well as actually shape. They become a little bit more rounded and less elongated, mm-hmm. just slightly.
Also, this is not the 6-hour exponential growth.
No, this is my bug.
This is your bug, and it's growing slowly.
It is more so. This is closer to like a 3-hour doubling time. Yeah. So to see that it took, you know, an hour or two to slow down is actually only like a half of a doubling time rather than some much longer period of time. Yes. So that's growth. But another way that what we really care about, so as to say, what selection is acting upon, of course, is fitness. And so we could just define fitness, and the next thing we can actually measure it is the relative reproductive success of one genotype versus another. Usually, the way we define this, because we do this in this relative way, is we think of this in kind of a pairwise scenario. And as I'll talk about then, if things are simple, like if all that matters is how I eat glucose, then fitness values are actually transitive. And so if I know fitness from A to B and A to C, then I can calculate B to C, and that's very much what I measure. If there's more interesting things going on, which absolutely could happen, two substrates, they feed each other, they kill each other, it won't be transitive, and that's something I'll talk about later. But so, like I said, why would you bother with competition? And there's really kind of two aspects. One is that typically is more accurate. Well, depends on what your assay is. In our case, it's more accurate. And it gets all phases of growth. And frankly, it can at least just be easier because you're taking kind of an initial and a final point. And so what does this look like? Essentially, you've got, you know, your minus 80, and you inoculate say ancestor, and say an evolved strain, it can be whatever. And it's important to give them a couple phases of growth alone to acclimate. Because typically we'll take a relatively small volume out of the freezer. You don't want to use up your minus 80 stock in an instant. So even though the transfers are done, say, with 100 microliters, you may not use so much to start these initial flasks. Give them some period of time to kind of get in, so that you want this for those in evolution about, you want kind of a carnivore experiment where you're growing things under the exact same conditions. You want to give them time to kind of get used to whatever life you're about to test them in. But then you mix them together, and now grow from one or more if desired. And you take time zero, time one, or later times if you want, time points, and traditionally, you can do something like count the number of, you know, these red and white columns, right?
So it's RMR, neutron.
Traditionally, yes.
So say you see something that looks like this, where initially there's equal numbers of red and white, and rules demeaning being white. You can use this, and I'll talk about in a minute how you can calculate fitness. You can use this as your measure. And so you need, what's key is you need to have some marker. Like I said, so Aratlos is one. You can use other factors to do it better, actually. And what's important is it needs to, you need to be able to distinguish the types. And you want it to be at least close to neutral. If it's not exactly neutral, and you know how much it's not exactly neutral, you can correct the things. Because you know if there's a 1% cost, and that cost really doesn't depend strongly on some of the conditions you're testing, then you can just kind of control for that. If it's a big cost, then I think it's going to just become more and more problematic. But so a lot of things, like under glucose growth, the Aratlos marker is effectively neutral. It's of course not neutral under Aratlos. It is neutral under glucose. This is how things have been done before.
And Chris, so before you go on, I just two questions. So are each of those arrows a, say, 24-hour growth cycle?
Usually, yes.
So, and how many do you typically do? Just
so I do two cycles. So I have an initial growth of about a freezer, where often the initial dilution may be rather small, maybe a couple microliters or something like that. But maybe then, instead of taking 7 hours to grow, it might take 8 or 9 hours. But because they're going to sit around for some period of time and have a whole other cycle, that usually comes out in the wash. And you can test it, right? Because you could only activate for one cycle and test fitness, or activate for two or for three or four and see, would my results matter? But so usually, I think I would do two cycles.
And then you also have the kind of, you do each experiment twice with swap marker, right? So you swap
you
the
could.
Marker.
You don't actually, well, so it depends. If your marker is very close to neutral, it often does not matter.
But how do you know unless you swap and unless
you can compete? You can compete this, like say your ancestor. Your ancestor with one marker type versus like itself that's not marked, and so you can measure the neutrality of the marker.
Right. No, I understand. But when you acquire a mutation, etc., the neutrality can shift as well. So in this sense.
If you had some sort of epistatic interaction between a marker type and mutation that occurred later, yes, these things could change. I don't know a good example of this, but it's certainly at least possible.
With GFP, that happens with GFP.
I could imagine
if you use GFP, YFP as a marker, that actually comes.
And it depends upon. It depends upon like, the expression levels and what system in terms of how they're truly using GFP. But that's nice because that brings up the next thing I was going to say. So we have been using a fluorescent ancestor rather than a Aratlos. And this is the reason why. It's because, and this is what David Chad did set up, is then you can use flow cytometry. And for those of you who are not familiar, this is where you pass a mixture of cells, essentially a single file line, past a laser. You can count many things. You can count just the number of things. You can also measure fluorescence, fluorescence, size, hair, all sorts of stuff. And what it means then is instead of counting say you on a plate, you might count 54 reds and 113 whites. And then the next plate will be 58 reds and 102 whites, etc. There's a lot of fluctuation in the kinds of numbers that you typically will get by doing plate counts. Quite a lot, just because of small numbers. Here, you can, and it takes a shitload of time to actually pull all the plates, do all the dilutions, do all the counting. Whereas if you use a flow cytometer in 40 seconds, you can count 50,000 cells, and you know there's not that much numerical fluctuation when your count is 15,000, right? And so you can get way, way better numbers by doing things this way. And this is the alternative. So this is Zach Blum, who worked on the citrate story in Rich's lab. And these are the plates that went into that one PNAS flavor.
Rich said that's a quarter of the plates.
Is that a quarter? It's believable that it is only a quarter.
But can you go back and just tell us what's going on in the figure that David made? What are we seeing? I mean, okay, I see so T0 and T1, but...
Yes. So what we're showing here, so fluorescence is on the x-axis, and then the number of counts. And so you can gain. So in this case, we're doing simply a fluorescent ancestor and a non-fluorescent strain, because I didn't have this fluorescent system set up when I started the experiment. But after the fact, I made a better marked ancestor to be able to compete against. And so in this case, you're looking at no signal versus signal. So what better scenario for your finishes, it would be to have like to start some of your population say with a red marker, some with a yellow, and then compete against the opposite, because then you can gain two dimensions and it's super, super, super clean. Because as you can tell, there's no points in between, there's a little tiny bit, and there's little tiny details. For example, a very small fraction of the
fluorescent cells, if you run them, say, all by themselves, will show up as being non-fluorescent. And so it's something you can control for, but it's better to just not have that be true. So I'm showing this as a one-dimensional histogram. If you had both, say, red and yellow fluorescence, then you should, you'd have quadrants. You'd have, like, just yellow and just red. And so if you had, say, loss of fluorescence at some low rate, they're just going to show up in this last quadrant that you're not counting anyways. And so it's nicer if you're doing kind of one marker type versus another marker.
So, but are those histograms?
This is histograms of fluorescence. Yeah. So this
is of a mixed culture, or
the signal of yes. So this is a mixed culture. So this is unmarked and marked, and then changing with time. And you get the spike because there's just this long tail of events. They're all just because of the way that it's being presented gets stacked up as the single lowest value because it's on a log scale.
So, Chris, what specifically is fluorescing here? Is it RFP and
so in this YFP case, it's Venus off of a relatively modest. So, one of the things we thought. So there's a trade-off in that you need to express. So, if you're going to use fluorescence, and by far this is what most people are turning to using, it needs to be bright enough to distinguish them, right? And so, you know, if this mean was down here, it'd be worse. If it was down here, it'd be worse, and it'd be unusable. You know, it just going to move towards being unusable. The problem is, the more you express it, of course, whatever problems there are only going to go up. And so there's a trade-off that you want enough to be seen and distinguishable, but to try to minimize the cost. And in any given system, it's going to potentially depend upon which fluorescent protein and, you know, what expression level you use. So in our case, with kind of just a modest but not super low constitutive promoter, and I turned to using fluorescent proteins, kind of newer ones at the time at least, that are relatively bright per molecule. So to try, given, you know, if for any given molecule there's this trade-off, but if I change the molecule, I can shift where kind of the line is. And so Venus is relatively bright per molecule, and M-cherry is the other one we've used. So for us, at least, like tandem tomato doesn't work very well. There's all sorts of fruits if you'd like to learn more. So in our system, at least, both Venus and cherry work well, and tomato does not.
37 degrees, right?
So this is actually at 30.
That's great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, as you'll see, right, like this is one of the things. If you're going to set up these, there are a lot of just little things to think about that can end up mattering. And you have to test them, and so we did. And luckily for us, this system actually works really quite well. And so we can measure fitness, even just with, say, like triplicate experiments, we can measure things to, you know, like a, you know, 0.3% fitness value, something like that usually. You want better estimate of the mean, do more replicates.
And you can get a fluorescent molecule on a plasmid?
No, it's on the chromosome.
Behind what gene?
It's a constitutive promoter, so it's LAC doesn't express very well. This is an alpha proteobacterium that I studied. LAC is very weak. A modified version of the LAC promoter gives at least okay expression. And it seems to express relatively similarly across most environments. So it's just kind of a modest expression. But you're going to have some noise, both from transcription as well as cell size, is why there's some spread here. And it doesn't come up with just a single value of fluorescence per cell, of course, and measurement and everything else.
Can you just say a little bit about when you strip single colonies and when you don't?
When you
take out of minus 80, say. Under what circumstances do you streak to get single colonies?
Ooh, that's actually a very, very, very good point. In the very beginning, I've had to bring up this point as a reviewer of papers, for example. When you start these, this is when it's important, each from single colonies. Because you want to make sure if you see parallelism, the same mutation occurring in multiple populations, how do you know it? So what's the alternative? I could grow up one starter flask of my strain and split the flask 100 microliters into each. How do I know I'm not doing a Luria-Delbruck experiment where there was some low frequency mutation there prior to selection that gets spread into the different wells? And so if you do it this way, if you streak single colonies and each single colony goes into a separate flask, it is possible that one of those single colonies did have a mutation that the other ones didn't, but it would be, but it would not, then you won't get parallelism from that, unless, you know, your rare frequencies should not be in the, you know, tens of percent, etc. Well, as long as it's one cell starting them. No, I'm saying as long as it's one starting the colony.
But you could have a mutation that's not
You absolutely could have it.
25% of the population that's not.
If your stock already has a mutation of 25%, you shouldn't be starting your experiment with. No, I agree.
What about single cell sorting, gating?
Usually that's not a concern. You could take a single colony, now streak that for single colonies. You should not. It'd be a very strange circumstance that within the growth of a single colony, a mutation would rise to 25% frequency. I mean, yes, it is occasionally going to happen, but it'd be extremely rare. Yeah. But so it's at this initial stage, I think it's really important. And then in terms of measuring fitness, you can actually, so there's two different ways you can measure fitness. You could often, for like a lot of what I'm going to talk about, what most people do, at some later point in time, they played out, say, the population at 20,000 generations, 500 generations, whatever, played single colonies, pick some random isolates, or maybe they purposely, you notice that there's some variation in terms of colonies, and you purposely want different types, whatever, and you test, so you're measuring a genotype versus a genotype. You can measure a population versus a genotype. That's a fair, but you need to make sure you interpret it correctly and you know what's kind of going on. Because if it's a population, then like how you acclimate them matters substantially, because you could be changing the frequencies of alleles within a mixed population prior to the experiment. So say I want to look at trade-offs, and I use a mixed population. It may be that most of the population has lost the ability to grow on something, but some of them still can. And if I acclimate for two entire cycles on said compound, the rare variants that can eat that compound will rise up substantially in number, and by the time I do my test, I won't see anything. So like for something like trade-offs, it's a really dumb idea. But if you're just simply going to look in that selective environment, you're essentially just doing two more phases of acclimation that were identical to the experiment before. The frequency should not be changing rapidly in time. And so you can actually, and we've sometimes done, a mixed population versus one genotype, if desired.
Chris.
Yes.
Could you say a few words about selection that could be going on when you unfreeze and freeze?
I don't want to. There's an interesting aspect, of course. So this has to do, I mean, generically as a microbiologist, in terms of strain management. If you save some, especially say your ancestor, you should save multiple vials, some of which you just don't touch, that are archival, and then you have some stock that say the lab will go into to make their own working stocks. So there'll be some stock that maybe gets dipped into once a month or something like that. You make a vial that you'll use for the next period of time, and then you go back to make a new vial, etc. But then you should hopefully have a vial that sits around that never, unless there's some disaster, gets touched. Because yes, cells survive freezing and thawing, but they don't all survive, and it is possible, especially if it's a mixed population, that there'll be differential survival. And if you go through, so it's one thing, you have to go through this at least once. There's no way we can live life without it. But if you went through this multiple times, you absolutely can. And somebody in Rich's lab actually did an experiment where they went through freezing and thawing, and then growth up, freeze and thawing, grow up again. And you can have very strong selective coefficients on surviving freezing and thawing. And so it is important to try to think about kind of aliquoting things off to minimize that effect, absolutely.
I have a suggestion, not a question, but actually a suggestion and not a question to the audience. How about, I have a feeling that Chris has gone through about the first 15 minutes of his lecture. So what if we have a little moratorium on interruptions, at least for the next 15 minutes? And don't forget that everybody's around, and you can also ask Chris the technical questions offline.
That sounds fun. So pretend you're biologists just for 15 minutes instead of physicists, all right?
Actually, can I just make one comment first?
You're a biologist.
That's really important because you're taking things from the wild, and things change a lot in those first generations as you take them out of the wild. So having that stuff, and then everybody has sort of a different ancestor once they've even grown it up for a few generations into one culture. Have you ever looked at whether they're different? I mean, they lose their integrated elements, they offload baggage, and everything happens early, we think. So, have you looked at
it? I don't know of anyone who's tried to look kind of at that kind of immediate timeline. Do you know, Paul, anyone who's done that? I'm not sure. It would be, certainly it would be interesting to consider, especially if you had some reason where you had something that had kind of a really high rate of mutation.
Well, and in a way, that's a disadvantage to going with the wild strain, because it's got everything,
true.
It hasn't been already through those first.
Yeah. As long as it takes at least a little bit of time for that to occur, then that could actually be quite interesting, right? Because whether it be neutral or selective, to have that occur in different populations, I think is actually quite interesting. If you can start your experiment before it happens. But yeah, when you go to start these cultures, I think it is important to kind of try to minimize the amount of growth between kind of knowing that you have a pure stock and actually starting off the populations. Absolutely, yeah. But if it happens faster than like the time growing up within a colony, then you may be fighting a losing battle.
Yeah, especially going from a wild state, not a landscape.
Yeah.
What you were saying, you did.
Yeah, that's true. Definitely. So, fitness. So, from these data, you have a change in the ratio. And so, if it was mainly red, so often, by the way, so typically, and because this will come up in a minute, often this will be, say, 50-50 volume, just because it's easiest. So if I normally would have transferred 100 microliters, now I'll take 50 microliters of each of the two strands and then compete. There are times, and I'll talk about it if I get there, where you might want to think about this. Because if things are transitive, then it won't matter. I will beat you if I'm common, I will beat you if I'm rare, and by the same rate. As I'll talk about later, it can matter, certainly. But this is at least kind of the standard way that things are done. And so in terms of calculating fitness, then what do we do with these numbers? And so you can think about this in terms, essentially, you've got, so one value that's calculated is what's called the Malthusian parameter. This is nice because I actually get to write out equations, which will make some of you actually happy. So where you're just looking basically at the change in the log ratio of the two types of time. And this will be something in a per day. So it's basically a growth rate per day. You can think about it as growth amortized over all phases. And the average will actually be the number of generations times natural log of 2. So like the Malthusian parameter, the average Malthusian parameter here is like 4.6, because it's 6.6 generations, something like that, approximately. And so, but it's basically, like I said, it's a growth rate that's spread out as if it had a constant rate from the time you started till 24 hours later. If you just kind of connect those with a, on log space, with a straight line, as if that was how they grew. And thus, fitness of one thing versus another. Like I said, I'm typically going to be talking about here at least relative fitnesses versus like some absolute fitness, some number of like growth per time. It's simply the ratio of these parameters for one strain to another strain. Right, and so the fitness of one thing to another, this is a relative parameter. So there's a unit for like a growth rate, right? It's something per time. But because you're not taking a ratio, it's unitless. And so, for example, if fitness of two strains is 1.2, that means I is 20% higher growth per generation than J. And thus, if we're talking about selective coefficient, say this was one mutation. Doesn't have to be if you're just measuring fitness of two strains, but if it was just one mutation, then SI is just simply the fitness of something minus one, right? So in this case, it would be 0.2. A single mutation of 0.2 would mean your fitness would now be 1.2. And this is adaptation. So another little thing, we talk about a positive value of S is a good thing. In a lot of population genetics, they just assume everything is bad. And so like if you look at like mutation selection balance and look at what S is there, it's a positive value, but they're actually talking about a deleterious mutation. So it's worth being just a little bit cautious in terms of what context one is thinking about life. But here, 0.2 is a good thing. If it was bad, I would describe it as minus 0.2. So that's that. And you can also sometimes talk about, instead of a selective coefficient, you could also have, so this is a per time, per generation, you can also have a selective coefficient rate where it's the difference between the two. And this is approximately equal to the average Malthusian parameter times the selective coefficient. And the reason why you might want to calculate a selection rate is if you want to look, for example, at what should be the dynamics of a mutation through time. And so for haploids, if we were to look at the change in some allele through time, it will look like this. And because you now want to look at something per time, this is why it's important to have now the difference of the exponential rates rather than the ratio of the exponential rates. And if you were to look at two different things, mean fitness and log of the ratio of that new genotype, and this is going to go. Start this. So the fitness of the ancestor, we usually, because this is relative, we think about the ancestor's fitness as being 1, however fast it is, slow, good, you know, whatever, it's just simply 1.0. So if you, well, we can think about, close this for a second. So if you, let's consider 3 different mutations, say of 0.2, 0.1, and 0.05. And if any of you have read Rich Linsky's first long-term paper, this may look somewhat familiar, right? This was one of the things that's in there because I think it helps develop an intuition for what one should see in these populations. What would the trace of mean fitness through time look like? What kind of shape would this have? I didn't see your finger fast enough.
Straight?
No, actually, on the bottom, yes, it will be straight. So if we look at, so any mutation, for the moment it arises at least, we'll start, of course, in 1 and n, right? So it's going to be some very low number, low frequency. And so if we consider like these 3 different mutations, on this space, they'll essentially, you know, they'll look. Like this, 0.2, 0.1, 0.05, because the selective coefficient is the ratio of the 2 different exponential growth rates, and so the increase of one type versus another will also be an exponential process, and it'll be constant through time if you plot it on a log space. But what does that mean then for mean fitness? By the time this 0.2 strain gets to be, you know, close to all of the population, if I make this 1.2, then, you know, the mean fitness in the population will now be it, because it's the main thing that's there. But what you'll actually see is this sort of, this should be rounded too. That there'll be a lag. So if you look at the mean fitness of the population, of course, it's not going to change very much initially. And then you'll see this relatively quick period of time, and then it won't change very much. And it's just, so it really is a constant process. There's nothing punctuated at all about it, but it's just a transformation of kind of an exponential process changing the average of, you know, a large number of things. And so smaller, you know, so a mutation, this is also assuming strong selection, weak mutation, one thing at a time, which never ever exists, but let's just pretend that it does. Then a, you know, a weaker mutation would do this, and a weak mutation would do this sort of thing. That the smaller the selective coefficient, it, you will rise to a lower value at a slower rate, and it'll take longer before you kind of have noticed that something happens, right? So I think that's enough in terms of thinking about like fitness and things like that. How about I'm going to table sequencing in terms of how do you find these mutations. I think it's an important point, but if anyone's curious, I mean, I'd be happy, if people just don't know anything about it and want to know something, I'd be happy to chat about it later in terms of kind of what this is like, but I'll say it can be done, luckily. And you get data that look essentially something like this. You've got a reference sequence, and you get lots of short reads. In this case, I think we're showing 36 base pair reads that Nigel aligned to the reference. And so this shows a case where the highlighted column has a C there, and basically all T's. And yes, there are errors. If you look through, like the sequences aren't absolutely perfect, but they're actually remarkably good. So needless to say, it is possible to actually find the damn mutations that occurred because you could sequence. And I can also, if anybody cares, ask, you know, why can't you just use other genetic approaches to find them? Which almost anything kind of traditional will tend not to find the mutations that arise due to adaptation. Great. I will say, though, what do the data look like? And so sticking with the E. coli example, so this was a recent paper, Jeff Barrick's in Nature last year, I guess 2 years ago now. And so 20,000 generations, it's like, I'll spare you guys, I often ask my class, how many mutations do you think there'd be, right? How many, you know, synonymous versus non-synonymous, you know, et cetera, how much should fitness have increased, things like that. And so it turns out that after 20,000 generations, there were 43 events. And the way, there's more on here than you need to care about. These circles moving out through time are time. This is the first one, the sequence at 2000, I think 2, 5, 10, 15, 20. So a mutation that showed up, say, at 5, and then you see it again at 10, at 15, at 20, et cetera. That's something that fixed. But I'm not concerned about that part. What I wanted to point out, though, is this, for example. SNPs are the black and the purple, and they call them dips. For kind of other sorts of deletions, insertions, et cetera, polymorphisms. And if you look, just approximately, that SNPs are about half. Which means about half the mutations are not what we typically talk about. So like when we will typically say, mutation rate equals mu. There's some mutation rate. Well, yes. That's true. We're usually talking about point mutations, and it's usually measured from like one thing, like streptomycin resistance or something like that, and you calculate and extrapolate from there. But even if that value is perfect for point mutations, there are so many other sorts of things that actually matter to adaptation, some of which can be a hell of a lot faster than point mutation, that it's worth being just a little bit cautious. So if you want to, say, use a non-mutator and a mutator, you've changed one of the mu's to the point mutation rate. You probably have not changed like the transposition rate, the recombination rate, all sorts of other things. And so to the extent that these other processes are going to affect change in mean fitness, you may not care, or it may be that your experiment will completely go wrong. It just all depends. So one thing that I'll also say is that there's, if you look at protein coding versus intergenic, so there are tons between genes. And there's, of course, multiple explanations for why. If you told me this was two different E. coli strains that have been separated for millions of years, I'm going to say, well, maybe a lot of that is that there's less purifying selection on intergenic regions than on coding regions. In this case, I think that it's actually a bias towards there being relatively more large effect beneficial mutations between genes rather than within genes over this timeline. And so we can talk more about that later, but given that the genome is like 97% coding, and yet the SNPs are close to like 50-50 as well as a lot of the other events, there's a very strong bias for intergenic. And then even those that hit coding genes, there's a bias towards them being transcriptional regulators versus other sorts of genes. So those are the sorts of patterns that have come out that are likely, I think, to be common once more and more things have been sequenced. One interesting thing, DS, no synonymous changes. And it's just barely on the borderline of ridiculous, like moving into ridiculous that you'd have zero in 20,000 generations. Other populations, there were synonymous. So yes, you can have synonymous mutations in E. coli, but it just happened to be in this isolate there were actually none. That almost everything was, all the SNPs were non-synonymous.
So how many would you have expected?
I think the expectation was something like 4 or 5 or something like that. 4 or something like, I can't remember. So.
There's also tons in this context means a large fraction of 43.
What's that?
Tons in this.
All right, small number. So of the, say, 20 SNPs, they're approximately like 10 and 10, 10 between genes and 10 not. So it's not a large sample, but still, it's large enough to rule out that it's 97-3. Yeah. So that's all. And a lot of them, which aren't really, all these blue ones are transposable elements. So little jumping genes. And there are actually quite a lot of them. They actually were a large portion of what occurred. Many of which that have been tested have been shown to be beneficial, not just random, high rate of occurrence events. And so if you look, for example, then this is showing now fitness measured via colonies, counting red and white colonies, and this is in blue is the number of mutations. You can see a very common trend in all these experiments. Very fast adaptation in the first, in this case, like 1,000 generations. 2,000 generations, I think, may be the first time I can remember exactly. And then increase, but much slower. But also, note how much the green dots are jumping around. This is because it's a horrible assay of red versus white. I do not believe, like, people have looked for like non-transitive effects and haven't found them. So at least there, if there are non-transitive effects in this population, they're weaker than the assay can pick up. And I don't believe that the mean fitness is actually dipping in a population size this big. No, there's not going to be drift strong enough to do that. I think it's just there is so, the assay is basically so horrible that you cannot distinguish what the real dynamics of what's going on. I think with Tim Cooper now has made a similar source to what I was talking about for these long-term lines. And so I think we'll at some point see a better picture of actually what the dynamics are. So don't read anything into those going up or down. One thing to note though is the number of mutations. So even though the fitness went up a ton and then it was slower, the number of mutations is not as punctuated as that. I wouldn't exactly, if you really look at these points, say that the rate is constant. It's somewhat faster earlier and somewhat slower later. But it's not nearly slowing down the same way that fitness is. But an important point is, in this relatively slow fitness increase period of time from like 2,000 generations on, there are still a relatively constant occurrence of more mutations and more mutations and more mutations. And many of these also, so two other points I want to make is that you can't read any of this, and I don't care. There's a lot of parallelism, including like three loci that all 12 populations have mutations in, none of which are the same mutation. So it wasn't parallelism, like neither did they uniquely occur in all populations, nor were they just simply in the, you know, like some low frequency contaminant, et cetera. But there are at least some sites that really matter for the cell, and others that have some intermediate degree of parallelism. And then where tested, most individually beneficial.
So these mutations, do they usually just destroy a gene, or?
It's a good question. There are a couple. There's deletions of the ribose cluster. They're of different length, but all of those just eliminate the ability to utilize ribose. So that's a loss of function genetically, but a gain of function
fitness. That's surprising that it sort of, that it's different mutations. So you can destroy a gene in many different ways. So.
Yes, but there are other examples. So like there's one SPOT right here that 64% of the time showed up, and we know that they are gain of function, or at least change of function. They're not knockouts, it's an essential gene. And so there definitely are cases of parallelism that are not knockout, but some of them are knockout of the function of the gene, but a gain of fitness, yeah. So that is not been addressed in a ton of the cases.
So is it a knockout of translation or expression or whatever? So why is fitness gained by knockout? I mean, one possible explanation is that you don't waste the material on something mm-hmm. that you don't need. And is there kind of an insight of what is it, how the knockout actually worked so that it eliminate kind of what stage of process did it eliminate?
So for the ribose cluster, I'm not sure, for sure. It might very well just be eliminating making it. One of the other ones that appears to at least be a knockdown, maybe a knockout, is actually pyruvate kinase. And one interesting, too, which I could go on forever about it, not that I haven't already gone on forever, is that is trying to, how much of this could you have actually guessed beforehand? So this is E. coli on glucose, right? I mean, we know more about this than just about any other circumstance. And yet, if you were to ask the ghost of Minode, what would you need to do to make E. coli faster under these circumstances? I would very strongly bet against it. There's one mutation that seems to relate to glycolysis, and even that's indirect, in that there appear to be knockdowns of pyruvate kinase. What does that have to do with glycolysis? It would mean that you're not, that you'd be building up PEP, pyruvate phosphate, and that is what's used for the PTS system to bring glucose into the cell, which is actually also an artifact, bringing up like what Matt mentioned before. E. coli growing in the lab uses the PTS system for bringing in sugar. So the glucose gets phosphorylated during transport, essentially. So it's glucose outside, but the time it gets inside, it's glucose phosphate. That's not how they live in the gut. This actually is known, that they use a completely different system in the gut that turns glucose into gluconate in the periplasm. Then the gluconate gets brought in to gluconate phosphate, and it goes through a totally different pathway. And also interesting from the point of view of kind of natural ecology, is that this first reaction going from glucose to gluconate E. coli can't do on their own. They require a cofactor called PQQ, pyroloquinoquinone, which I only know because methanol dehydrogenase of my bug requires the same damn thing. The E. coli doesn't make, even though they need it for this reaction. But they are like, you know, 0.1%-ish of the gut, and a ton of other things like Bacteroides make PQQ and Klebsiella and all sorts of other things. And so they get this cofactor they need to be able to actually eat glucose from somebody else in the gut. So how they live in the gut on glucose, however fast it is not how they do it in the lab. So it's yet another, so like what we think of as like the way that organisms grow on glucose is not even how E. coli grows on glucose, which I think is kind of nice. Yes, but the point, tons of parallelism, where they've been tested, tons of them are beneficial. So the main point I want to make is a majority of these mutations appear to be beneficial, not even neutral, and certainly none of which appear to be deleterious, at least on the background they occurred. There's one only that was deleterious when individually introduced into the ancestor, which probably suggests, though it's not yet been at least published, that there's some sort of epistatic interaction with other mutations that occurred later.
So the inset in the top panel
says, yes.
Over the next 20,000 generations, there's 12 times as many mutations?
Yes. This is the part that Paul would really like. This becomes a mutator, but late relative to those that he studied. Somewhere between 20 and 40, it became a mutator, which means there was a mutation in mutation repair. And then now, from that point on, you went from 43 mutations to like 600 plus. Now there's a shitload of SNPs. There are a ton of SNPs, tons of synonymous. A lot of these probably are not selectively beneficial, and some of them may even be deleterious because now the mutation rate is probably like something like 100x up. So now they're behaving kind of more like people may have expected. They're just, you know, at a kind of a faster rate. But prior to that point in time, almost everything that occurred, I would guess that 80% of the mutations, at least, are actually beneficial.
But fitness-wise, when it became mutator, fitness-wise, it was okay.
It was okay? No, it hasn't at least yet. Maybe Paul would like to, you know, speculate more to would it eventually, but no, it hasn't
yet. Well, eventually is another story, but experimentally it did not. Right?
So neither ramped up beyond the rest or shot down.
So it was plateau.
At that point in time.
Yes. A question about the noise and the data. So in the upper graph, you said you don't trust in these fitness runners jumping around. They jump around by 10%.
Yes. Yeah.
So how much can we trust the table two in the bottom?
These would have
lower than 10%.
Right. So everything above like probably the 2%. So some of the, one difference is these, because they were studied individually, they would do like 10 replicates. And so it did enough that you could reduce the, you know, your confidence in the mean. Whereas these, I think, because they ran so many points, they were just triplicates. So I'm pretty sure this was triplicate data. I mean, yeah, you could, if you did 30 experiments for each one of these, now your counting noise will be reduced, and you actually would get a good picture. Just be really, really, really a pain in the ass relative to doing this.
I'm trying to understand the green curve. So the green curve is for one individual strain out of 12.
It's also one I
averaged out over.
One isolate. Oh, this one is one population.
Right. But this is a kind of generic feature that there is this large jump.
Yes.
You know, first five mutations give you a large jump in fitness, and then it's much slower.
Yeah, absolutely. It's even true within those first five that things were relatively faster, even in the first 2,000 generations. Again, mean fitness between like 0 and about 200 or 300 doesn't change. But because they're coming, but they haven't yet risen up to be frequent enough to be sampled. And then there's a relatively fast period from like 200 to 700 generations, something like that, and then relatively slower from 700 to 2,000.
Okay. But the real puzzle is why the genes which give those, you know, those five mutations, five SNPs or maybe deletions, which give you such a large effect are not very parallel. Just looking at this table, the top one is top A, which is top isomerase, which changes expression level across the genome. So it's kind of easy to believe that such a large genome-wide changes could, in principle, be fine-tuned to be beneficial if you want to change. But then, at the same time, there's the same top A is only observed in 20 in the upper table. It's not very, you know, ubiquitous. It's not that it happens all the time. It only happened in.
One thing, it's yet to be published, I believe, but there's some work suggesting that, like, even within a population, there you have multiple different genotypes fighting it out via kind of clonal interference and whatnot. And there are a temporary winning genotype can end up being the eventual loser, because there may that some genotypes, even though they're of lower fitness at that moment, appear to be less kind of adaptable under like those circumstances. And so because of epistatic interactions, they may have kind of climbed up a, you know, the steep but short peak, you know, in terms of, dare I say, you know, bringing that sort of a picture of things.
But can it be that this first fast stage is not just mutation, acquisition of mutation, but fixation of already existing very small, like the Brook experiment, so that basically you had some diversity in the population, and the very kind of very small.
No, because none of them are the same mutation.
Fixes.
If they all fix the same mutation, then I would believe in like the Luria-Delbruck. But they're fixing different versions in the same loci, but they're different versions. So I don't think that they would, like it was a single pre-existing.
You can have initial pre-existing diversity in this.
But again, you streak out for single colonies. And so you streaked out, and then you take 12 single colonies, and each one of those single colonies starts a population. So again, unless you have some rare variant that's so frequent that you'd be likely to sample it in, you know, one out of 12 or multiple out of 12, then you won't see it just because of that. And again, if you saw it in multiple of them, then it'd be the exact same mutation. In this case, there were different mutations.
But in the same locus.
In the same locus, but different mutations. And only rarely even in the same amino acid, often there have been multiple.
See any evidence for Muller's ratchet? Just the accumulation of deleterious mutations?
Later, maybe. I don't know if they've looked at anything. Like, I would believe that it would be possible, you know, that you'd have accumulation of deleterious things once they became a mutator, absolutely, but not. There's no evidence of it earlier on.
So selective sweeps are occurring or are not occurring?
Well, genotypes do eventually win, but not one at a time. Nothing close to one at a time. I mean, there are enough other people I think we're going to talk about that sort of thing that I'll leave that be, but I'd be happy to talk about it.
These are also large populations.
There's such...
Yeah. I didn't... Say it again?
These are large population sizes, so I think Muller's ratchet is relatively weak in this regime.
So the process that's more appropriate, it's more described as draft than drift, that the timeline for a purely neutral event to occur, like this is way, way too short, 10,000 generations, given that it's millions in the population. The type of neutral events, or mildly deleterious, that can rise are those that are on the same background as beneficial. And that sort of event can happen quickly, and certainly could contribute to some limitations that we're seeing here. All right, so. Let me try to move on a little. So again, mutations are not just substitutions. I want to mention one example from our own lab. I'm not going to talk about it in any detail whatsoever, but we saw in a series of populations that are actually in different environments, 80% of our isolates lost 10% of their genome. Not exactly the same. They were different events, and they were recombination between different IS elements. It didn't occur fast enough to just be only mutation rate, because we did a mutation accumulation experiment. So everything I'm going to talk about here, you want, so to say, selection to be dominant. If you go through single colony to single colony to single colony to single colony, now, of course, drift can very strongly influence things. It's not to say there's no selection. You can have selection, like you'd have some mutation, but then selection occurring like within colony, etc. And it never occurred in the same number of generations if we did that type of experiment. We need to say massive deletions of the genome, like I said, 10% of what is a megaplasmid in the strain. And I'll just say that we've been able to recreate these big deletions. And first of all, they're actually beneficial. They're not just neutral or deleterious. And so it's different than what's thought to be dominant in terms of, like, say, intracellular bugs. It doesn't simply scale with the amount deleted. So this is not like Goldilocks. A little deletion is small effect, middle-sized deletion is middle effect, big deletion is big effect. It matters like which part. It's like two half deletions have very different effects from each other. They're environment specific. And even though they're beneficial in this context, we even were able to find some context in which the deletions were deleterious. No doubt in nature, there's even more conditions that they may very well be deleterious in. But so again, mutations are not just point mutations. It can be all sorts of rather dramatic effects.
So Chris, just for purely speculative reasons, mm-hmm. how much of the genome would you imagine was lost in these strains before the lab experiments Lansky began?
Oh,
since it had been grown in the lab for 50 years.
So they haven't lost that much in 20,000 generations since, but it's been selection dominant and not drift dominant. And there may very well have been things early on that would have been a larger effect that would have already occurred, et cetera. And it was a different environment, survival on an auger slant or something. My feeling, the genome size is kind of average for E. coli, but average has quite wide variation. I don't know, maybe they lost 2%, 5%? I don't know. I think a relatively small amount would be my guess. I don't know. We're curious ourselves, for like the Methylobacterium strain that I study. We actually just dug out from UK kind of an archival version of our strain. We're going to sequence it and see how much our strain has changed in time, because different people's wild type don't behave the same, which is actually a very common phenomenon. That, you know, as these various events have occurred, different people have gone on, depending on your own academic lineage, your strains often have the same lineage, and the people will get different results and whatnot. And it's a great case of coevolution, really. You can make phylogenetic trees of people and their I think it'd be a very strong coevolution signature. But I have no evidence. It's just a feeling.
There's an insertion element that went in and then it got deleted? Is that what you're
saying? Already there.
Oh, they're already in there.
There are already two copies, co-directional, in recombination between them. Okay. And because there's more than two copies, you can get either these two, or those two, or these two, etc.
Okay, so is that how it got in, do you think, originally? Or was there an integrase? I mean, if the plasmid isn't exciting and still around.
So the part of the plasmid that goes away is the part that, of course, does not have the recombination apparatus. The plasmid becomes two circles, but only one of which is still a plasmid, the other is just a circle. And so now that part goes away, and the other part is kept.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It also makes a good case that it's a megaplasmid and not a second chromosome, and that it is not only not needed, but actually beneficial to ditch it under these circumstances. Yeah. All right, great. So selective coefficients. So what time do we want to stop? I can go forever. So whatever you like to stop.
And I think it's been for 2 hours.
Well, I guess the question is
hour long.
The question is how much. So roughly where you are. I mean, it's possible to
75%
schedule a second installment, or for example,
I could do either way.
You can get to where you want to be in half an hour.
Yes, absolutely. People will operate. That's easy. Great. I get paid by the minute, right? I just want to make sure. So often when you see an equation, there'll be values like mu, which I've already made comments on, that is not necessarily a single value. You'll also see a value like S, a selective coefficient. And it's important, I think people think about it, then often sometimes dismiss that, of course, S is not just a value. And it can it can change upon many things, and there's ways to experimentally address these. It can depend upon whom you're competing with, potentially, as well as their frequencies. If it's non-transitive, where things are not simple and straightforward, it can depend, of course, on the selective environment. What's beneficial in one can be neutral or deleterious in another, or just differently beneficial. And it can also depend upon other alleles' presence, epistasis, or G by G, if you want. And so, in terms of fitness being a function of frequency, there's a really simple test that people might mention, and it relates to the competition I brought up, where you can, if I plot out kind of a competition experiment, but in a different way, I put time here and proportion. So the typical experiment is you start approximately 0.5, and you look to see what happens. Does this line go up? Does it go down? Etc. And let me actually. This line. I'm going to leave this at 1.0 and 0, but I'm going to draw things in with straight lines just to. Indicate things being kind of constant in time. I'll screw the log. Okay. So if two things are neutral to each other, for example, of course, where their fitness are equal, then, and if that doesn't depend upon frequency, you would, if you start them at 90-10 or 10-90 or 50-50, it won't matter, and other than drift, they'll essentially just hang out as straight lines. And there's nothing, no frequency dependence, but in that case they're neutral. How these experiments look when they're not neutral, of course, would be something like this, that if we start them 50-50, say one strain wins, so in this case, so this is proportion x to the with fitness of x is greater than y, but it is a constant, then it doesn't matter. If I bump it up to 70-30 or down to 30-70, that, you know, it'll essentially, you know, increase at the same, you know, kind of rate. You're kind of irrespective of where you start, if things are simple, non-transitive, etc. But this is not always true. And this is exactly the kind of experiment you can use to find out when it isn't true, is you can look for frequency dependence and fitness. And there's two different possibilities where you can have fitness, say, you could have some cases that look like this, where I can start at different frequencies. And if I start with, you know, this is a proportion of x, if I can start with x high, it'll come down. If I start with x low, it comes up. All right, now, so who's the winner? Nobody is an absolute winner. It depends upon kind of where you start in this scheme. And so this is what's called negative frequency dependence. You can also have the opposite scenario where you have this sort of thing through time. And you can have positive frequency dependence. So in the first, you're more fit when you're rare, and the second, you're more fit when you're common. And I've drawn both of these as special conditions, as you'll see, where there actually is some balance point. You don't have to have a balance point to be frequency dependent. But so, can you think of a biological example of each of these two? There are some that have been shown to fit. There are multiple types of biologies that can fit this bill. No guesses? Or you're just hungry? Okay. Sebastian scored well in my class, so I'm sure he already knows, but yeah.
Putting him on the spot. Classic example in evolutionary biology, although it's across species, is two different forms of mimicry.
Interesting. Yep,
sure. Batesian versus Müllerian mimicry.
Cool.
And Batesian mimicry is a species that's tasty, mimics one that's nasty. And if the tasty one becomes too common, then the experience of the predator is positive, and the tasty one gets decreased in numbers.
So that'd be the top.
That would be the top.
Yeah.
In Müllerian, two nasty things mimic each other, and there's obviously strength in numbers.
Yeah, great.
But there's relative number as well as frequency involved in that example, so it has to be
sure. And that is actually another, I'm not mentioning it, absolute number can matter besides just frequency. But the classic
examples are cheaters and calculators. So if you kind of play this evolutionary game, if you start from high proportion of cheaters, it will go down. If you start from low proportion,
depends upon the game.
Depends upon the game. Well,
snowdrift.
Actually, yes. Yeah.
Not prisoner dilemma. Yeah. But yes. So the easiest example is something like crossfeeding, say at the top, where one thing, say, is eating glucose and spitting out while they're growing fast something else, not because they want to. Perhaps because they do, but they don't certainly need to have there be any kind of reciprocality. And then another strain that can survive, can eat the first substrate, but is good at eating the secondary substrate. And so they can coexist at some frequency. And positive frequency dependence one is something like toxin production. And to have this kind of balance point is if toxin production is costly. And so like in a well-mixed environment, if I make some toxin to kill my partner, but there aren't enough of me to pass the threshold, I need to decrease my competitor's growth rate to a value greater than the cost of me making it. And if I'm below that value, I'm gonna go down, which means I'm making even less. And so I'm just gonna continue to go down. Whereas if I get above that point, there's enough of me to hurt them that they slow down relative to me, I increase in number, now there's more of me to hurt them and more, et cetera, which is why these even, you know, increase in frequency. And so the key point, I'll actually skip to the next slide, is that So in this case, you can end up with X and Y coexisting, and in this case, kind of an X or Y being the winner, that it depends upon your starting point, whether nothing's absolute. And for these two conditions to be true, so like to coexist, there needs to be negative frequency dependence for this to be true, and cross 1.0. Like there has to be not only just a negative, if I were to plot fitness as a function of frequency, not only does the slope have to be negative, it has to cross one. Because if I beat you really fast when I'm rare, but I still beat you when I'm at close to 100%, then you're just gonna lose. just you're going to lose more slowly as I nearly kill you. And same thing with positive frequency dependence. So if it's negative frequency dependence and crosses one, then you have two different domains. You know, you have an attractor as in terms of a stable point. For positive frequency dependence, same kind of thing. To get this kind of ecological bistability, right, where either the system moves to being all one or all the other, it not only has to have a positive frequency dependence, some sort of feedback, but it has to cross one. It has to be a value below which I would lose and a value above which I would win, right? Yes, and so to some extent, then, so the nice thing about competitions, you could say also, is that they have the potential to capture this, but it's also the curse, because then if this is going on, what does a fitness value mean? Right, that suddenly it's, again, it's not a value, it's much more context dependent, and one needs to be really, it's really the fitness of this strain versus this strain at this frequency in this environment, you know, it's like it suddenly becomes so dependent upon all these various factors and can change through time, etc., that one needs to be kind of just cautious and it's still a really useful thing to do, but one needs to, you know, what we often really want to know, like what you really want to know is like, say you know, we sequence those 40, got those 43 alleles in the E. coli strain, what you'd really like to know perhaps is when, you know, on the genetic background that this mutation arose, in the context of the other strains present, what was its relative fitness advantage? That's what we often really want to know. And how much a competition will tell you that depends upon how complicated both epistasis and interactions are. And like I said, the nice thing, you can at least detect them if they're there, but if they are there, then one needs to kind of just slow down and think about what you're really doing. And really simple models may or may not kind of take advantage of things clearly. So there's that. I'm not going to mention the last thing I already did. So another thing, it obviously fitness the fitness advantage of a mutation depends upon the environment. And there's very commonly the idea that while you're getting better on one thing, you'll tend to get better on another thing. And perhaps the more I get better in environment A, the more I'll decrease in environment B. This is kind of a very common intuition, and whether there's any support or not, you find it in a large number of, you know, various ecological models and things like that. And the only point I wanted to make with this slide is, and other people have seen certainly, is be cautious, because there may be trade-offs, but there very well may not be, and I'll just mention the kind of the highlight that from work that we've done, for example, where we involve in two very different substrates that the bug that I study can grow on, and in this case, like open circles means you can't grow, and closed circles means you can, so it's just being qualitative, but all those that grew in one environment could still grow across on every substrate tested, essentially, and those that grew in another environment, half of them completely lost the ability to grow on anything that's a single carbon compound. And so there were trade-offs, but it was asymmetric. It was only in one direction. It wasn't kind of something like seesaw that, you know, either one going up or down would matter. And also, some of the lines, so like some of them completely lost the ability to grow on methanol and things like that, and others didn't. And in fact, not only did they not decrease in fitness, they actually increased in fitness on the alternative substrate. And so there was no direct selection while you're only on substrate B to be able to grow well on substrate A, but it can be completely you know, up to chance in terms of, was there a mutation while growing on B that had antagonistic pleiotropy that made you lose something in the first environment or not? And so it can, in this case, it was kind of bimodal. Sometimes we saw positive correlation and sometimes negative correlation within the exact same experiment, and it was asymmetric substrate versus substrate. And even though, even if you don't see trade-offs where things, one goes up and one goes down, you can still have enough specificity and adaptation that if we had a case where we looked at multiple different environments, two single resource, the mixture and the alternating, and if people are more curious about this, I can talk about it later, and then we tested all the strains across all of these different things. And the simple thing is to, like, basically, with the exception of what I just mentioned, that if they only grew on this one substrate, half of the strains, these kind of down here, half of the strains completely lost the ability to grow on this, they could grow in the other two environments. Other than that, all boats floated. In all environments, they improved on all substrates. However, there was enough specificity in terms of how much better they got on this versus this versus this that we could actually use like a discriminant function analysis and be able to look at, these are the actual past environments and the predicted past environments based on today's fitness, and reasonably well, not perfect, but reasonably well bend things into where they actually came from, even were they in a mixed or were they in an alternating. And I'll also say that an alternating or a mixed environment is not the same as the average of two single substrate environments. Like, there are details to whether you have to switch or whether you eat them both, like do you eat them at the same time and you do whatever. And so be very cautious in terms of multiple substrate environments, either temporally or together. It's not the same as just an average of AMD. And then the last thing is, so epistasis, certainly something that will probably come up later, where you can look at mutation combinations. And so a classic example is work that Dan Warnick did, where he took many different mutations within beta-lactamase. I'll actually show his data analyzed in a particular way. But we made all combinations of four alleles. And this is where I'm going to end things. That we found in a particular experiment. For now, I'm not going to bother with the details of the experiment because that would take more time. But needless to say, so this is the ancestor, denoted as 0000, the same way that Dan did. And this is the evolved strain that has all the alleles. So the nice thing is then you can look at what's the effect of adding the same allele, evolved allele, in place of the other one on this background or that one or that one or that one, et cetera. And so because there are 16 combos, you have 8 different backgrounds that each allele was being added onto. And so and you can even already see from visual inspection that, for example, on the ancestral background, the green mutation has a 0.5 advantage, 50%, 51%. This is bigger than is normal, at least, in experimental evolution, commonly, except for phage. Phage go crazy. And on the most fit, at least, it's only like a 35%. And it turns out that there's a fairly consistent trend for most of these alleles that, and I've normalized things so it's kind of simpler to see, that you take the selective advantage where one is just the highest selective value that it ever has on any of the backgrounds, that for, not for the blue, but for the green, the red, and the yellow, that there's this consistent trend that they become less and less advantageous as the background you put them on is more and more and more fit. And this is very different. This is now looking at epistasis between genes. And this is extremely different than what Dan saw in terms of looking at epistasis within proteins, as well as others, Tony Dean and Joe Thornton, for example. Where if you take, so I took his data and analyzed in the same sort of way, where I took the relative selective advantage. In his case, he was looking at the resistance of various alleles of beta-lactamase, and normalized it in the same way. The greatest proportional resistance, no added, and notice, in his case, he even had some cases where an allele would be negative. That it would decrease the resistance to add a particular allele, even though sometimes adding it on was beneficial. And here you can see there's no trend. I had to put on a log scale because the MICs changed by like thousandsfold just to be able to see it. But any given allele, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, there's not any average trend with the resistance of the allele before. It very much matters, as they talk about in the paper, in terms of is it, you know, stabilizing allele is good when it's with something that changes the active site, not so much with another stabilizing allele, et cetera. So it depends upon kind of the details of the protein. And what's interesting is that these are our data from Methylobacterium, some kind of crazy, wacky experiment. Tim Cooper did the same sort of analysis with the first 5 alleles of E. coli lines that I just showed you and gets the exact same result. Most of the time, they see antagonistic epistasis, which is also nice, because this is what was inferred by Sergey and others in terms of looking at the combination of how fast the adaptation was slowing down, yet mutations were linear-ish with time, can be described as you would infer from that a general trend of antagonistic epistasis.
One has to worry about what kind of alleles these are. So yes. In fact, so you just said, if you look at the alleles that arose in some sort of selective protocol, you may find one thing, and if you just collect some random alleles from
yes.
All over the place, and you construct your little hypercube, you may find something else.
Absolutely. And so I think that's an extremely important point. People have done this sort of thing usually pairwise and usually knockout mutations, right? So like every yeast knockout and every other yeast knockout and all combinations and things like that, where that's an extreme case, right, where you're just getting rid of genes. Or people have also taken random mutations that have never seen prior selection and done sort of things. And even there typically has been a bias towards antagonism. But what has not been seen has been beneficial mutations. And so the nice thing is, like with Dan's, as well as this, all these mutations are ultimately beneficial. There was selection upon these, you know, successively on the backgrounds they arose. And even despite, like, you think, like, if selection had a choice, wouldn't you prefer synergy? Right? Wouldn't you want to have, if anything, you know, like, you just want the best, the next best step that's possible, and then the next best step that's possible. And so, if anything, there's going to be a bias.
Synergy, it's you prefer no interactions.
Well, synergy would be even better, right?
Well better, but
yes. Right, but even in the face of selection, the general trend here is toward is antagonism. And yes, it matters what the types of mutations are. So what I wanted to end with is, so it turns out that this system that we evolved, it's a bug I studied, methylobacterium, it's not E. coli, it's not yeast. It can grow on things like methanol, oxidizes that to formaldehyde, and then grows from there. And the initial strain, I engineered a horizontal gene transfer into it. I ripped out its old way of growing, took out its formaldehyde oxidation pathway, and without it, it can't grow at all on methanol, and put in a foreign pathway, a different system that's completely non-orthologous, different chemistry, but it accomplishes the same type of task. It gets you from formaldehyde to formate, but completely different genes. And at the time when I set this up, I only had a really strong promoter, free-floating on a plasmid, to be able to do so. And if I put in this foreign pathway, they can grow, but they grew really poorly. And so the hypothesis was then that this specific change made them so slow that the biggest beneficial mutations will have to do something with what I did, and not the topoisomerases and SPOTEs and all the other weirdo sorts of stuff that showed up in the E. coli lines, but something that's kind of more specific to what I care about. And in fact, we even have a metabolic model of this part of the cell, and so we can even try to relate predictions to what we see. But I'm not going to talk about that aspect at all today. Needless to say, they improved very fast, right? You start with something that's very unfit, another thing that's a common trend in experimental evolution. The less fit your ancestor is relative to kind of wild type, the faster they improve. So these improved, you know, up to like twofold in 600 generations. So similar extent to Rich's, but his went for 20,000. There also happens to be quite a spread, actually. Some, you know, like the variants may or may not be collapsing, but we for other reasons, stopped the experiment at this point. What was interesting is that we also noted that our ancestor, besides growing really slowly, had really messed up morphology. And so this is what methylobacterium kind of should look like. And a large portion of the cells in our initial ancestor with this foreign pathway were elongated, curved, or branched. I mean, for a bacterium to do this is kind of weird, right? And this is not what they some do, but these bugs do not do that commonly. And if you look at the proportion, then so like this is the wild type before messing around with it at all. This is the engineered ancestor. And then this is an evolved strain. And so it became messed up. And ultimately, like you don't see those morphological problems anymore. And you can also look at the average cell length, and the same thing happens. It goes up and it comes back down. And it turns out that of these four alleles I was talking about, three of them suppress this effect, and one does not. One of them that suppresses this effect is a mutation that actually turns down expression of both of the genes. So they were too highly expressed. And you can turn up expression in wild type and make these defects happen and make a fitness cost happen. So this problem is directly being caused by too much expression of the foreign pathway that I introduced. And so not surprising, if you turn down the foreign pathway, there's less cost, and you see less screwed up cells. What's interesting is two of the other mutations indirectly also reduce the proportion of messed up cells. Why do I bring it up in this context? It's because the exact same three mutations that show this antagonism are the same ones, so like these three that reduce the cost are those that show antagonism. And there's one mutation, this other, that appears to increase their growth without affecting this cost. They're still screwed up looking. And it shows no general trend. The blue points show no general trend of antagonism. And so when we thought about this, kind of to put it first verbally, is that if you have some cost, so if you can grow at some rate, and you have some cost, so imagine each of these, it's not exactly half, they actually reduce by a little more than half, but you can imagine if each of these mutations cut your cost in half, and say your cost, you know, I'll just throw out a number, it was 40%, then the first time you cut the cost in half, you'd get a 20% fitness benefit. But the second time, you now cut your cost in half. Even if there was no epistasis at the level of how they interact on the cost, the fitness benefit would only be 10, and then the next one would only be 5, right? And there's going to be diminishing returns if they interact kind of independently on the phenotype, but if the phenotype is only one part of the total fitness. And so the way that, and this is work that I've done with Daniel Segre's lab in terms of a very simple model, where normally we think about fitness, I'm going to rewrite slightly You see, each mutation does something to kind of the original fitness, which is the same thing as writing just WI times WJ. And where we think of life as being one phenotype is the simplest possible proposition, and that mutations interact multiplicatively. And why multiply? The idea of using multiplication is the idea that there's a constant proportional effect. If two things were truly independent, like say, if you're a plant, if I could either make twice as many seeds, or my seeds would germinate twice as much, if I did both of those things, would I get three times as many seeds if I added the effects together, or would I get four times? I'd have four times, right? Because I'd have twice as many seeds that also germinate twice as frequently, right? And so the idea, if they are truly independent phenotypes, that you should have a constant proportionality in their effect. So this is how epistasis is typically, and the way I'm writing this, lambda is just 1 plus si, is to think about this as one phenotype. But in our case, we wanted to separate fitness into thinking about it as having a benefit component and a cost component, where the benefit is essentially the rate of growth independent of cost. And then C0 is a set amount of amount due to protein expression. And thus, each allele could affect benefit, or it could affect cost, right? Or potentially both, right? And so you could either make it go faster independent of cost, like the PNTAB, one of the alleles did, or it could, like three of them do, at least partially affect the cost itself. And so then we propose from this that if you had two mutations, they would enter the proposition. It's not to say that this is reality, but we're proposing this as the null model then, would be something like this, where if these are kind of two independent phenotypes, the benefit and the cost, then that each mutations would, even if we assume kind of no epistasis within each phenotype, but because they're now separate, as you'll see, then this introduces the possibility for epistasis. And so this is thinking about the mutations having independent effects on each of the two sub-phenotypes. And so the nice thing is from the data, we know for each mutation, we know its selective effect. We know the cost, because we can measure just making the proteins to an empty plasmid, and so this turns out to be about 14%. We're estimating theta I, so how much are they proportional to the cost from looking at how many the proportion of messed up cells. So is that a perfect proxy? No, I'm sure that it's not, but it's something. At least it's some visual, some observable that is caused directly by the cost. And we're saying for now that it's linearly proportional, the number of messed up cells being proportional to cost. It's just a proposition, but one that can be tested. And from these, we can then calculate B0 and lambda I. There's no free parameters. But now we can ask, given each of these mutations, so like I said, three of them are cost reducers and one is not a cost reducer, we can ask, well, how would they interact with each other and how does that compare to what we actually see? And this is what we get. So I'll start with the non-cost reducer, PNTAB. This has to do with metabolism outside of the cost. And the data, as well as the model, are that there's no particular epistatic effects. The straight line is the effect, the SI in the ancestor, the original selective effect. So if there was no epistasis, like every point would be exactly on this line. It'd be the same proportional effect, irregardless of your background. And that's essentially what we see for the PNTAB. However, for the others, we see this antagonistic trend. And the nice thing is it's antagonistic except for when a cost reducer interacts with the non-cost reducer. And those are the ones that are with the asterisk. For all the asterisk cases, both the data and the model pick up this kind of this deviation otherwise. So like if two cost reducers interact, there's antagonistic epistasis because they're affecting the same phenotype. But if a cost reducer and one that makes you grow faster, independent of cost, interact, you don't see this, right? And so that's the simple result that we see from this model. And so what I think is exciting about this is both consistent with what people have predicted from just looking at the trajectories of fitness and mutations through time. This is only four loci in one strain. But there's also the five loci in E. coli that Tim looked at, and four of his also show this trend. Interestingly, one of his mutations shows synergy with fitness of the background, so that the more and more fit the strain is, the more and more proportionally advantageous the mutation is. And we actually also, in the past, have already published an example of exactly the same, a mutation that becomes more and more and more useful as the fitness of the strain is faster. And I can explain why I think that that's true. But I think my feeling is, so this is only 10 mutations, but at least across two different systems, that if I were to guess, most mutations, even in the face of selection, beneficial mutations are going to interact antagonistically. There will be some that don't. But I think the general trend is going to be this, and I think it's going to explain a large portion of why adaptation slows down. Like in our case, where I showed the curve of adaptation, the fit strain has an advantage of about like 94% or something. If you were to take away epistasis, so as to say, it would be like 2.3. It would actually be closer to a straight line, at least for this period of time. Ultimately, I don't think epistasis will explain all of why adaptation slows down, but I do think it's going to end up being a substantial proportion of what's going on.
Yeah, it was. So basically, you're saying that, you know, once you've reduced cost, reducing it further isn't going to pay off.
Exactly. Simple. But what's interesting is, so we've also got that, you know, very. What's nice is even very simple propositions of thinking of fitness as being kind of the sum of multiple different components can introduce epistasis at the level of fitness.
There's one kind of epistasis that really depends on how you measure what you measure.
Yeah.
You know, there's some kind of transformation which you can do with pretty much any scale of function that's going to introduce sort of various of interactions between different summons.
Yeah. But what I think is interesting is that in this case, I mean, we're only assuming, it's just a null hypothesis, that the mutations are interacting independently at the level of cost. They may not be independent, even at the level of cost. But what's interesting is how well the data can be explained, even with that really simple assumption. And even with the simple assumption that like the proportion of messed up cells tells you something about how much cost is being reduced. Even given kind of these two things, which either one could be bogus, we still can very well reproduce no free parameters, the actual observed data.
But there are somehow two issues. One is sort of diminishing returns, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, of course, very sensible and plausible. But the point here is that all the mutations that you see are beneficial from word go,
yes.
Which has to do with how they got into population in the first place.
Absolutely.
And how they spread it. Whereas there is this other effect that you mentioned it. Ben's story with sign epistasis, or right, actually where you have multiple mutations that are necessary to get
each one was successively beneficial, right? They just kept selecting on the allele to get to the 10 star.
Well,
right.
In the order that they found them.
In the order that they found, but each one in the order that they were found was beneficial.
Yeah.
So it is the same in this case. So I think.
Okay, but I guess good. But there's still the question of you can imagine, right, that you have to cross the valley, right? And maybe the valleys never get crossed, right? And we can argue exactly what it takes to cross the valley, right?
Yeah.
And so you certainly see this sort of epistasis if you again cross diverged strains, right? Whatever, outbreeding depression, right?
Yes.
So I guess the statement here is that if you pick out alleles evolved such as they were, you are not going to find that we're not seeing valley crossing.
Yeah, there's no valleys.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a smooth, it's bending over, but it's a smooth landscape. They're always beneficial. And so like one thing that we want to do next is we sequence another strain. So like what about even between two different adaptive trajectories? So even if each one was conditioned upon being beneficial, what if you now combine them because they never saw each other? My hypothesis is that at the very least, the selective effects will be worse on a background you haven't seen than they are on one that you have. And they may even be cyan epistatic. And we have some examples actually already of different mutations that occurred in different populations that when combined together are deleterious, even from something very simple like gene expression. Two mutations that both decrease gene expression, one say affects translation and one that affects copy number of the plasmid, you combine them, and even if we just assume that these things interact multiplicatively, we can also measure them, that you can end up being too low of enzyme, and now it becomes deleterious again.
Well, not a very crossing effect. It's a smooth landscape where you go, but not linear, kind of. It's a landscape which plateaus, and so then you move from plateau to the slow part, and then you get
I mean, I think your point is very...
So maybe I misunderstood the distinction that you were making in the beginning of the presentation. So in the beginning you made the distinction between evolving sort of a broad phenotype, if you like. So there are many ways in which you can adapt your... improve the bug in your environment, right? As opposed to there are many fewer ways of developing antibiotic resistance, right? So you may think of this as, in some sense, mutational target perhaps in one case is smaller than in another case. So
wouldn't you expect the opposite? Mutational if you had a smaller target, it could be less likely to sign up this case?
Stop talking here because let you finish. Because I think I'm taking this on a tangent.
But I think your point, I mean, to some extent, it's an echo of what we had at the beginning in terms of, your environment and the strain is going to change things. And what I think is important here is that even in an experiment that's essentially a parallel to like what Dan looked at, that was within a protein, and this is between genes, and they're categorically different in terms of kind of the qualitatively how things interact. And it's only a couple examples, but it's possible that kind of biophysics within a protein and the way networks tend to interact are qualitatively different. Not always, but the trends, I think, have a chance at least to be so. But I completely agree also that how the mutation, whether they're deleterious mutations being combined or just random or beneficial, matters. But even so maybe you could think of this as like in the process of climbing, whatever peak, that at least that peak itself is not very bumpy. It's not to say that there aren't other peaks and that if did this in different experiments and then had sex with, and horizontal gene transfer between them, you could absolutely see other sorts of things in valleys, et cetera, but at least as I'm climbing my mountain, there aren't tons of little rivers and gullies is perhaps something. So let me just close by saying I'd be happy to talk about 14 minutes of animation on this. Lots of other things. If anybody who cares about that? I do care about money, even in a sense. But if anybody has interest in other, I've been trying to be relatively pedagogical as I was asked to, and certainly extended in time, which will double my pay. But I am interested in lots of other kind of specific questions. If anybody happens to be interested in codons, which I already heard mentioned, or cooperation, or lots of other things, I'd certainly be happy to chat as well as further about this bit. And people give me money, which is kind of remarkable and strange. And this is my lab running the rhinos outside our building. Yes. So,
Chris, what do you think is, how relevant do you think what you've been studying is to natural variation and diversification as opposed to simply mechanisms of genetic interaction?
Good question. It's hard. The very reasons why a system like this, so like as we're writing up this paper and about to submit, why would we use this system? And one reason it's really nice is we have a great fitness assay, which is a pragmatic issue. And because the adaptation was substantial early on, there are large selective coefficients so that we can actually confidently measure changes in those very selective coefficients. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be able to measure whether there was epistasis. Because if your assay is plus or minus some percent and the selective coefficient was 0.1, then you can't even tell whether it's happening. I'd love to know, of course, whether, like even let's say at the end of the Rich-Lenski, later on in the Rich-Lenski experiment, if we would go out to 40,000 generation, if we could measure those selective coefficients, would you still see the same sort of things? Like, is this only a trait of large effects? I don't know. I think my intuition is that it's at least possible to be relatively generic, but absolutely with exceptions. We've had exceptions from our own lab as well as others, because this is positing, you know, independence of different phenotypes and, you know, a very, 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 you know, we're only kind of, instead of considering fitness as one phenotype, we're only pulling out one aspect and saying, all right, you're important enough that we can treat it special as your own, and everything else we're still lumping together, which is ridiculous. I mean, ideally, we would want to treat, you know, everything that's going on in a much more fair way. And like within metabolism, you do things like metabolic control analysis. There are reasons to believe why things, there are different like topological considerations that would, if two things are converging to something that you need, you can have synergy between them versus other sorts of scenarios where you'll tend to have antagonism. Like, I think there are general trends to be found, and that will be true for natural strains also. But the selective coefficients in nature, it may be smaller if you think of things as living in a constant world, but maybe the life of a microbe is more like I land in one new lab environment, and then I land in a different new lab environment, and then I land in a different new lab. Like, each time as I move from, you know, the lake to the gut to the lake, I'm going to start adapting. And so maybe like there's it's actually a series of rapid adaptation. I'm not sure. Again, I think I agree with Paul. Like, we just, as great as microbes are for the lab, unfortunately, they're equally bad in nature in terms of a lot of things we would want to know about their actual life. I don't know.